Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. You have to do something extraordinary to involve more than 100 notables at one time, including, get this, all 6 living presidents of this nation. HBO does, on this Independence Night, The Words That Built America. Emmy Award-winning producer-director Alexandra Pelosi joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. Make sportscasting with The Wonder Years or something close, and you have play-by-play. The drama we're launching earlier this week on smart TV and device distributed service Rated Red. We'll check in with creator and executive producer Kevin Dopofsky later this hour. And we'll bring June to a close saluting a groundbreaking TV classic, Monty Python's Flying Circus. The writing trio behind new book Monty Python FAQ stop in. Chris Bartanti, Brian Cogan, and Jeff Massey. And they'll have the answer to this week's Python trivia teaser, we hope. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later this half hour. Great to have you wrap up, June, with us on the program All About Television this Friday afternoon. Happy to have you aboard. We're here in the Big Apple. It is bright and humid at 85 degrees at the top of the hour. So wonderful people are headed your way over the next 90 minutes, and we invite you, as always, to be part of the program. It's so simple. Raise your voice, pick up the phone, and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio. Our chat room is open for business as well. It's Simon Apple 04 by name. You can find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. We have 2 news note quickies en route to our first guest. Dear White People, Netflix's dramedy based on the famous satire is coming back for a 2nd season next year. And just a few moments ago, HBO announced that George Lopez will be doing a live comedy special, The Wall, from Washington, D.C. in August. And that is news notes for today. And now joining us live from New York, the Emmy Award-winning producer-director of The Words That Built America, upcoming Independence Night to HBO, Alexandra Pelosi. Alexandra, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how did this project get underway, and how fast did it spread in terms of becoming the production that it is?
Well, after the last election, I was talking to Sheila Nevins at HBO about how this country is so divided and how no matter who won the election, half the country was going to be disappointed. It's really easy if you live in Manhattan to say, oh, I'm not happy with the results, but half the country was happy with the results. So we were trying to think of ideas of something we could do that would unite people. What's an idea of something we could get everybody to do that they could agree to do together in a documentary? And the only document that we could come up with that we could get people to talk about was the Constitution. So we invited all the living presidents and vice presidents and 50 U.S. senators and all the Hollywood A-listers to come in and read from the founding documents of this country. And it was just an open casting call. We just sent out a generic email to all the publicists and just said, hear ye, anyone who wants to participate, you're all invited. And we cut it off after 25, we had 25 Republicans, 25 Democrats in the Senate, and then we cut it off. And then we had all the, we accepted all the Hollywood A-listers that would come, you know, the Morgan Freeman and Meryl Streep and Robert De Niro. But then we had the problem of having too many liberal Democrats from Hollywood. So we needed to do more Kid Rock, Toby Keith, Peggy Noonan, you know, any conservatives we could find that were famous, big name conservatives, because those are more hard to come by. So we tried to make it really super balanced. And we got all the, you know, Rumsfeld and Henry Kissinger and Hillary Clinton, all those kind of people to do it too. The idea being that the one thing they would all do is get together and read the Constitution. So that's the story behind The Words That Built America, which is airing on July 4th on HBO.
Guest 698, by the way, has just came into our chat room. Simon Apple 04 by name. Thanks for coming in. If you have a question or a comment for Alexandra, put it there or give us a call. That's 646-652-2906. At any point in putting this together, did your brain go off and say, what the heck did I get myself into? Can I really pull together all these people from all these different backgrounds and all these living presents and vice presents to do exactly what I'd like them to do?
Well, it was easy because it was the Constitution. It would be hard. You would never get a whole list of people like that to do anything but. I kept saying when I was in the Senate, I kept saying to everybody, all the senators were lined up, and I'd say, I could not pull out the menu of what's for lunch in the Senate cafeteria and get the senators to agree to read that. They'd fight over the ingredients of what was in the menu of the Senate cafeteria. They fight about everything. This is the only thing that they wouldn't fight about. When I really thought I had gotten in over my head was when I had to do the Bill of Rights, because those are the amendments to the Constitution. So free speech, due process, things that really matter. And that gets very political very quickly. And there's a lot of fighting about who is going to get which amendment. So in the end, that was when I just aborted the mission and said, you know, I'm going to let kids do it. And I just went to a school and got the kids to read the amendments, because it was the only politically correct way of being able to go, I mean, right to bear arms. I had Gabby Giffords read it. And then I knew that that would infuriate the people on the right. But the funny thing is, she's a real advocate for the, I mean, you know, it's complicated. Even though she was shot in the head, she still believes in the right to bear arms. So it's more nuanced than you would think. They want to say they're for gun legislation, you know, to prevent the amount of guns that get out there, but they're still in favor of the Second Amendment. So it's complicated. But I didn't want to get into that. So I had Eminem lined up to read the First Amendment, but then I knew that Mitch McConnell and Dick Cheney weren't going to appreciate being there with Eminem, you know? So I ended up just saying, forget it. Let's just go for the kids. It's the easiest way to get them read without offending everybody. Like, the Supreme Court justices wouldn't be in the same show with Eminem, you know? So I had to be – that was the only way to get kind of political about it.
How do you figure who reads what? You know, were there some senators or some presidents that told you, get me to read this? If you don't
I'm
going to drop out, or –
I let them choose what they read, because that way I wasn't dictating. Nobody wanted to read impeachment. I don't know how to explain this, but everyone has respect for the institution. No one wanted to read for impeachment. So that's an example of something that I had to say to Dick Cheney, you got to take one for the team here. You just got to read it. Because he's in the executive branch with all the other presidents, and none of the presidents were going to read the word impeachment. So he had to do a solid for the whole executive branch and just take impeachment. So that's an example of something. Everything else people were pretty open to. President Obama read, you know, If You're Born in the USA, which everyone's sort of amused by. Of course, President Trump wanted to read the Electoral College because that's how he became president. He and Al Gore, between the two of them, wanted to read that because Al Gore, that's why he's not president, right? And Hillary Clinton just stayed above it and wanted to just, you know, sort of a nice generic line without getting too political. I mean, you know, some people chose to take more political lines. Other people wanted to be, you know, politically correct. And then in the edit room, I just had to patch together and make sure I didn't have any holes, because that was the problem. Everybody wanted to read certain parts. Nobody wanted to read African Americans count as 2/3 of a person. And I got John Lewis to do that and Maxine Waters to do that. But I didn't find any Republicans who wanted to read that line. So it's, you know, it had some political stuff. But besides that, what people have to understand is it's a straight read of the documents, which I think all humans need to read, because I think that everybody's getting really emotional about politics these days. And this is the rule book of how our democracy is played. People complain a lot about our democracy. And I think that if you're going to complain, that's fine. It's very patriotic to protest. But you need to know what the rules are. And you need to know, because everyone loves to say, the president's going to be impeached. You can't just throw out words like impeachment without knowing what it means and knowing what the ramifications are. So how would that actually happen? Let's look at the Constitution. So that's what I was trying to do, is get people to pay attention to the actual rules before using certain terms that are in the Constitution so liberally. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. We have our friend from Philadelphia just entered our chat room, Simon Apple 0419. So welcome, and Rick, happy Friday to you. You have a question or comment, put in the room, or give us a call, 646-652-2906. We've got Alexander Pelosi, the Emmy Award-winning producer director of The Words, that built America. It's a unique special coming Independence Night. That's next Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on HBO. And in addition to the HBO presentation, it will also be running on HBO Video On Demand, HBO Go, HBO Now, and will also be made available free of charge later on HBO's YouTube channel in July. Alexander joins us live from New York this half hour. On Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Applebaum, we'll be live also from the Big Apple. Delighted you're with us, wrapping up your June and the first half of 2017 with us. If you have a question or comment, don't be shy. Raise that voice. Call in 646-652-2906. Again, use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. We're going to kick off July next Monday on the program with the person behind a very unique special that will be happening next weekend on National Geographic. It's Earth Live with Jane Lynch of Glee and Hollywood Game Night fame and Phil Kogan from The Amazing Race. They'll be taking viewers around the world, the very unusual facets of nature, all presented live. And we've got executive producer Al Berman joining us that day before Independence Day, next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. What do you hope, Alexandra, people get specifically from the documents that are going to be read? You have the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights. I want to get to the Bill of Rights because, as you briefly noted, you have a group of middle school kids who do that, and we'll hear more about that in a moment. But first, what do you hope people get just from reading these documents and tying it into Independence Day?
Citizens have a responsibility to know the rules of this country and to participate and really be active participants in their democracy. And so I think this is a start. I mean, the middle schoolers can recite this stuff. We should be able to, too. I think that I got a lot of questions while I'm filming this show about the actual documents. Grown-up, sophisticated Manhattan people would ask me questions. I'm surprised by the lack of education. I mean, it speaks to how bad our education system is in America. And I'll take the blame myself. I went to a nice Catholic school. We didn't memorize the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. I feel like people need to hear these words and have – this is the democracy, this thing we export all around the world. It's something that is – that the whole world looks to us as the role model. And ours has survived 240 years now. So this Constitution has some value. It's what's holding us together. It's like the connective tissue. It's the only thing we have left. And I do feel that if you like sports – and it feels like right now everybody's getting into the sport of politics. If you like sports, you should know the rules of the game. You should know how it works. You can just sit there and watch a football game if you didn't know, okay, how many downs, how do you throw the ball, you know, what is the referee doing? You need to know the rules of the game. And there are a lot of people watching all this cable news and getting all hot and bothered, and they don't really know the rules of the game. So I feel like that's what people need to sort of go back to the basics. I don't know if you remember during the election season, there was a whole, you know, everybody hold up your Constitution. Have you read this document? Everyone should read it. And if you have an audience in Philadelphia, we donated it to the National Constitution Center, so it'll be there anytime anybody wants to watch it. And it will be on YouTube. HBO is giving it away for free. So it's not just on HBO. You can go to YouTube and just watch it. After it airs on HBO, which is July 4th, you can watch it anytime on HBO YouTube, which is a free channel. So politics is all you can eat buffet of America right now. You know, that's how it feels. It's like everybody's just gorging on it. But I feel like they're gorging and they don't really know what they're gorging on. You know what I mean? It feels like they're sort of just binging on it and they don't really know what they're getting themselves into. It's like everybody has the appetite for it, but they don't really have the stomach for it, you know, to go. So this is just giving people a little, like, let's just get a little back knowledge that you should have gotten from middle school so you know the rules of the game that you're playing.
Mm-hmm. Do you hope that not just the special, but the timing of this on America's birthday, and it's one of the few original specials that will be on any network that night, that it might help to reduce the vitriol, it might help to or might assist in bringing us all a bit closer together in terms of being a little more respectful of each other. People of Congress, the president,
I
be more respectful of each other no matter what their point of view is.
I'm not that naive. I don't think that it's just, hey, let's watch 40 minutes of television and then kumbaya, we're all going to get along. I mean, I thought after the assassination attempt against the congressman last week or 2 weeks ago, everybody was going to just take a deep breath and be a little more careful with their words. And then you know how that turned out. I mean, now we're right back in the middle of the worst, grossest moment in American history. So I don't know. There's nothing that can happen anymore. It seems like nothing is sacred. But no, I mean, do I hope? Yes. I have to be the ambassador of hope. That's my role here. But I'm not naive. I don't think that people are just going to watch, you know, 40 minutes of television and say, yes, we can all get along. But it is nice to know that they can. It's good to know that, I mean, people have the impression, if you watch enough cable news and you overdose on it, you get it makes you angry. And people get the impression that the senators are just walking through the hall spitting on each other. They're colleagues. They work together. They have to get together. They don't agree, but it doesn't mean that they don't respect each other's opinions. I feel like we only focus on the plane that crashes, that one crash, instead of all the planes that are landing every day and all the good relationships that do exist in Washington that we don't know about. And I saw a lot of that behind the scenes. And I got to go, I mean, every person was a junkie's dream. I got to go into everybody's homes and talk to them. And everyone was decent. Everyone was super cool. Everyone was, you know, Democrat and Republican alike, they were all really good people. I didn't meet one jerk while making this film. You know, people have these opinions about these people, and you go into their home, you go into Dick Cheney's kitchen and have coffee with them, and you walk out feeling a little differently about the Iraq war, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, it did for me. It worked for me. So, I don't know. Maybe you see, people just need to have read a little more, get a little more information, and maybe it will help them feel a little bit better about the democracy they have to live with.
How long did it take you, Alexander, to put this special together, and where did you bring people to do the readings? Was it all in Washington, D.C.? Did you go to did you send a crew to different cities around the country to capture some sort of natural nuance? I'm curious more about how the special came together in terms of location and bringing people to do the readings.
My first shoot was the day after the election at the Carter Center in Georgia. I filmed Jimmy Carter reading the Constitution from beginning to end in his library there in Georgia. And then after that, I traveled into Texas for George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush. I filmed President Trump at the White House, Mike Pence at the White House, and then I went into people's homes. I went to Dick Cheney's house, Colin Powell's house. You know, I went into – everybody invited me into their homes. The senators were filmed. This is actually a funny story. You know, you have to be really inside baseball to understand this, but in Washington, D.C., a big part of what senators do all day is raise money to destroy each other. They raise a lot of money. So the Democrats have a headquarters. You're not allowed to raise money. You're not allowed to make calls to your big donors out of your Senate office. So what they have to do is they have to go over to the Republican National Senate Committee where they go make their calls. And the Democrats go to the Democratic Center and the Republicans go to the Republican Center. Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, for the whole Senate, but the Republican leader, invited me to the Republican National Senate Committee to film because he said, I don't want you using Capitol Hill as a Hollywood set, so why don't you come to our fundraising office? Which was really funny because I was filming the Republican senators in their natural habitat where they raise money. At the same time, they're coming in to read the Constitution, talk about how much they love America, but then they go into the next room and make these fundraising calls, which are about how the Democrats are destroying America and the Pelosi agenda is bad for America. And it was funny because I was sitting in the chairman's office and I was reading a letter that they were sending out to all their constituents talking about how Nancy Pelosi was destroying America. And here I am, her daughter, like reading this. And then Mitch McConnell says to me, he catches me reading the letter and he says, Alexandra, I bet you never thought you'd be working in a place like this. It was just one of those funny moments that this kind of program brought me together with Mitch McConnell and all the Republican senators. Just kind of a magical moment for me personally.
Now, there's a sequence where for the Bill of Rights and all the amendments, you decided to go to a very neat space, which is middle school kids involved with the United Nations. How did that come about?
Actually, my kids go to school there. I actually have a Dutch husband. He actually became an American citizen, though. And he's one of those geeks who, when he became a citizen, he had to take that test. And so he really has an appreciation for this country. He says his kids were born here spoiled and they don't appreciate the country. So he's always saying to the kids, you need to read, you know, 4th of July, he passes around a little booklet of the Declaration of Independence and makes them read it, right? So ever since he became a citizen, he's been one of those people who talks about how spoiled Americans are and how they take it all for granted. So he wants our kids to sort of have an appreciation of, you know, the Bill of Rights came out of the United Nations basically came out of the Bill of Rights. The founding, you know, motto, the, whatever the documents that founded the UN are basically the Bill of Rights. There's a whole backstory, a very complicated backstory. But anyway, so out of that, we send our kids there to this school, and so we just lined up the kid. All, we just did an open casting call. Did any kid? It's very hard to get permission to film children. So we just went to my. I have two sons in middle school, so we just went there and we did an open casting call and just let anybody come in and read. So we have the 10 amendments, which is the Bill of Rights, and then we have the other total 27 amendments. The 27 amendments total, right? We have all of those on HBO Go. So people can watch, you know, women getting the right to vote, abolishing slavery. Those are things that weren't even written in our Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Those are things that came later. So I have all of those things. At some point, I want people to pay attention, and that's why I brought in all the Hollywood stars and made the big, you know, I had that The Rock and Meryl Streep and Morgan Freeman read the Declaration of Independence to draw people in. By the time you get to the Bill of Rights and you see kids, it's cute, but you're a little bit done. You're like, I get it, okay? So I only did the Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and then I said, if you want to know more, go to the HBO.com and you can learn more. So that's why I ended up, you know, filming all these kids, middle school kids, because they have to learn this in school. They sit and memorize this stuff in school. So it's ironic that they know more about most of this than most of the U.S. senators. That's what I found. The kids, the middle school kids know more about their American history than most of the U.S. senators.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about The Words That Built America. It's a very unique Independence Day special, and it happens Independence Night, next Tuesday night, 7 p.m. East Pacific Time on HBO. We've got the Emmy Award-winning producer-director of this special, Alexandra Pelosi, with us live from New York here this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. 2 more minutes with Alexandra, Tom Appleband with you live from New York, and we're listening for you. So get on the phone, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple049. We're getting 698, and Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, is at. Next weekend, CBS premieres its latest primetime game show, Candy Crush. It's based on, yes, that very habit-forming smartphone and tablet game. We've got the executive producer of the show from Celebrity Name Game and Deal No Deal, John Quinn, will be joining us. And then the following Monday, we will have two executive producers of upcoming series. One is Susan Watson, Sarah Watson. She is one of the executive producers of The Bold Type. It's the new Freeform series based upon the work of Cosmopolitan magazine. And then we'll have the person behind such CNBC series as The Prophet, Amber Mazzoli, the head of Machete Productions. That's all coming up a week from Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. And amongst several other guests coming up throughout July will be for Propagate, Ben Simmons, the former NBC head, and Howard Owens, the former chief of National Geographic Television. They head that venture, and they're the folks behind Apple's first TV series, Planet of the Apps. We'll talk to them live about it. And also, we'll have the vice president performing for the up-and-coming series, the up-and-coming agency network, Acorn TV, presents the best of Canadian, English language performing in Britain and around the world. Dan Kleiss will be with us. That's all coming up in July, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, Monday and Friday, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Does it surprise you that we don't see a lot of original holiday programming on a place on a day like Independence Day? It looks like there's like three specials, your special, Capitol Plus on PBS, and the annual Macy's Fireworks on NBC.
Let's face it, I couldn't get it on the air. I couldn't have been gotten this project made if, you know, people didn't have it. If people had more options on 4th of July, HBO never would have made this movie. You know, that's the thing, is that sometimes there are moments that you can exploit. Like 4th of July, you know there's nothing on except reruns. And it's that weekend. It's funny, it's a weekend where everybody's already, by now, everybody's gone, and they're not coming back. And it's funny because this is a window where people just don't have anything to talk about. So that's why I'm trying to fill the void. But if I tried to, I originally tried to do this for September, which would be Constitution Day, but nobody really cares about Constitution Day. They should, but they don't. So it's a funny thing. I made a film once called, this is my 11th HBO film. I made a film once called Citizens USA, which was about the process of my husband becoming a naturalized citizen and giving up his citizenship. You know, you have to denounce your home country and pledge allegiance to the United States of America. And when I made it, I brought it to HBO, and they said, that's great, but you need to go to naturalization ceremonies in 50 states. So I ended up having to go to all 50 states to make the film, And it was fine because we put it on 4th of July. And what we learned from that film a few years back was that there's nothing on 4th of July. So we got a lot of play. A lot of people watched our show. We got amazing ratings. Everybody bought the DVDs. That was back in the day when people bought DVDs. And it was a huge hit. Why? Because there was just nothing else on. So sometimes the lesson for all the industry, you know, people that are working their way on the industry, find a moment that you can exploit, attach to some moment or some anniversary, because all the networks want to program to it. There should be more 4th of July programming. It's sad that there isn't more. I mean, there's some live from Washington, D.C. stuff, but most people aren't watching TV on the 4th of July. They're out celebrating with their families. But you know HBO, they re-air stuff over and over and over again a million times. So I'm hoping by accident people get stuck when they're having trouble sleeping at night. They'll have the opportunity to catch, you know, The Rock and Jack Black. Jack Black is great in this film. You know, who would have thought you'd say that Jack Black's great reading the Declaration of Independence. So, I mean, in the end, I hope that people catch it and they're stuck watching it just because of Jack Black alone, at least. Or, you know, so that's my sort of, like, tip for all those people out there that are trying to sell some product. It's like, attach it to something, you know. I bet you have a lot of people that ask questions about this kind of thing. How do you get into the business? How do you sell these things? How do you get them out there? And I feel like taking advantage of certain moments on the calendar is a really good opportunity. So next year, I want to have somebody else make a 4th of July movie. Somebody out there that's listening will make some great 4th of July movie, and you'll be interviewing them about it.
Absolutely. And by the way, we've seen this with the holidays now. We have seen original filming happen. Memorial Day, Hatfield McCoy's History Channel 4 or 5 years ago, that opened the door for that holiday. We're seeing now Labor Day, Liberty Night become a place for original filming. Love to see Christmas be that way, Hanukkah too. So why not the 4th of July? And incidentally, a wonderful producer named Dan Curtis made a wonderful film that is rarely seen called When Every Day Was the 4th of July. And somebody ought to bring that, maybe Turner Classic Movies, somebody should put that movie on. It's a wonderful film with Dean Jones that does not get a lot of play. I do know 1776, the film based on the Broadway play with the original cast like William Daniels and Howard De Silva will be on Turner Classic Movies. But yeah, there should be more original in the holidays. You know, I remember back in 1976, when it was the bicentennial, CBS had Walter Cronkite do an all-day event called The Celebration of Us, and it was placing CBS News correspondents all over the country to show, here's life on this day. And nobody has done a project like that since, and it would be great if some network, or Netflix, or Hulu, or Amazon, somebody did a similar show. There's so much great storytelling around this country that you could do on 4th of July. It would be just a great slice of life. And speaking of slice of life, what's your next project for television?
I don't have one right now because the way it works, I work exclusively for HBO. I have made that decision, and it's not the smartest decision because I have 2 kids and a mortgage to pay, so it's not, at the end of a project, the best decision. But I've decided to stay with one place because, you know, now there's so many options out there. I feel like it's so insecure, it's so feast or famine, it's so Darwinian getting work in this business. So I've just stayed in the same place for the past 11 films. So, but the way it works, when you finish a film, you can't be pitching a film until it's being pregnant. You have to give birth, and then you have to say, okay, now I'm going to have another baby. It's or it's like dating. You can't say, like, I'm going to go get another husband when you have a husband. You know what I mean? So there's a certain dance that I have to dance at HBO where I make a film, it airs, I say thank you very much, I let everybody go on vacation, and then I come back in September and I say, I have the greatest idea ever. Here it is. So I have lots of ideas, but as you know, ideas are one thing. Actually, getting into production and getting some pay for your ideas. This is a great dance between art and commerce. I have a lot of films I'd like to make, but who's going to pay me to make them? So that's what I'm going to find out when I get back from, you know, I have to, like, take my kids and do mommy camp for the summer so they don't get too sick of me. Because if you show up on July 5th and say, here's my next movie, they're going to be a little bit tired of me. So I have to wait a little bit, let a little time, like a little honeymoon period, and then I'll come back in September and pitch something else. So it takes about a year from project to project with these documentaries, but you have to build in that time after, which is like sort of the post-mortem on the last one. And it always depends if you got viewers. You know, you're only as good as your last show. So if this bombs, they won't pick up another show. So I have to sort of wait and see how this does, see if anybody likes it, see how the reviews are. You can always get some terrible reviews. And then see if they want to take me back in September. That's basically how it goes.
The Words That Built America, a very unique HBO special everybody should be encouraged to see, and I hope you do. Independence Night, that's next Tuesday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on HBO. Check your local for HBO available in your area on cable and satellite. And remember, if you missed the presentation, chances are HBO will repeat it not only there, but we'll also be running it on HBO On Demand, HBO Go, HBO Now, available on smart TV sets and smart devices also, and we'll be running free on HBO's YouTube channel. And I understand that some of the HBO affiliates will also be playing it on their video on demand channels free of charge as well. For more details about the program and the network, here's where you go, www.hbo.com. It's www.hbo.com, The Words That Built America, 7 p.m. Eastern Pacific on HBO. Alexander Pelosi, producer director of this wonderful special, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on getting it off the ground. Look forward to a lot of great reviews for your special on Tuesday night, and we really appreciate you taking the time before a great holiday weekend.
Thank you so much. What a total thrill it was for you to have me on your show. I'm so grateful that you had me on your show. And happy 4th of July to you.
Thank you very much, Alexander. You and your family as well. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Alexander Pelosi, Emmy-winning producer director of The Words That Built America, joining us here in New York. When we come back, we're going live to Sherman Oaks, California, and we're going to speak with the creative executive producer of the latest dramedy dealing with the world of sportscasting. A little wonder years in this, too. It's called Play by Play on Complex Network Service Rated Red. We will be speaking with Kevin Jagubowski when we return after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You are connecting with the best internet radio in the universe, www.blogtalkradio.com, more than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for Jamie Roxx's Pop Rock Radio. Check out Jamie and the kind of music and conversation they have Thursday, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best BTR available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back for more of this 90-minute closing edition of June of Tomorrow Be Televised. That's June 2017 to be exact. Simon Appleband with you live from New York. Delighted to have you with us. More guests coming your way over the hour ahead, and we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes, a ring from you. 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Or if you're in our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. You'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com. And joining us currently is guest 698 and Rick Webber, friend from Philadelphia. We'll get to our next guest joining us live from Sherman Oaks, California. But first, a word to the fine people at audible.com. Trevor Noah is doing very well with The Daily Show every night on Comedy Central and also his wonderful book, Born a Crime. And if you haven't checked out Born a Crime, you've got a chance to right now. Make your free audiobook from audibletrial.com/televised. Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. Over 180,000 titles to choose from at any given time, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio. Remember, just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. All you need to do, you get one free audio book, like Trevor Noah's book or anything you like, and a one-month trial of service. Absolutely gratis. And remember, because Audible is owned by Amazon.com, you know that the customer service is off the charts. So hear for yourself why Audible.com can transform the way you hear the world. AudibleTrial.com/televised. AudibleTrial.com/televised. One interesting themes taking some television shows in the scripted world this year is the world of sportscasting. IFC has done very well with it, with Brock Meyer, who's creator and executive producer, was on this program a few months ago. And I'll be very, very surprised if a couple weeks from now, Hank Azaria is not nominated for an Emmy Award for his fantastic performance in the title role. Well, today we have another show about the world of sportscasting, this time one with a little bit of the Wonder Years in it. It's called Play by Play, and you can get it with smart TV sets and devices that are connected to the Complex Network programming service, Rated Red. Joining us live from Sherman Oaks, California, another Interrate exclusive, the creator and executive producer of Play by Play, Keith Jarofsky. Keith, Kevin, welcome.
Hey, Simon, thanks for having me.
You are very welcome, Kevin. How did you come up with the idea of this mix of sportscasting and Wonder Years thoughtfulness?
Well, it was a couple ideas that kind of came together. The show is about an ESPN sportscaster who kind of looks back on his life in the 90s and gives sort of the play-by-play of his adolescence growing up. So And that way it's sort of like the Wonder Years meets Sports Center. So I think where the idea came from was a couple places. One, I wanted to sort of talk about and examine my own high school years, and specifically the high school that I had gone to, which was sort of a unique situation. I went to a Catholic high school just outside of Chicago, which had been an all-guys school for, you know, 60 or 70 years. But when I got there, they were making the transition to start accepting girls. And so as a freshman boy at a school, you know, that just started accepting girls, the juniors and seniors were all guys. So it was a very weird weird setup where, as a freshman guy, any girls in my class, you know, wanted nothing to do with a little 14-year-old dork when she could have a pick of any, you know, 17- or 18-year-old guy with, you know, with a driver's license. So I was, even back then, I thought it was kind of a funny scenario. So that was one idea that played into the show. And then the other one was just, when sometimes I think when you look back on your life, you kind of see it almost as a highlight reel. So when that idea kind of came into play, I thought, well, if there's a narrator looking back sort of Wonder Years style, it might be fun to see it through the eyes of someone who becomes a sportscaster. And that would give a fun little sort of comedic twist or lens to look at the world of high school. That's kind of where it came from.
Kevin, did you have ambitions to be the next Marv Albert or the next Kevin Harlan or the next Pat Summerall?
No, I didn't. I played a lot of sports growing up. I think that was really my interest. I never really thought about becoming a sportscaster or anything like that. But another thing that brought me to wanting to write this show was just sort of the portrayal of kids who play sports, particularly in high school. You know, a lot of times, especially in comedies, TV especially, you know, they're portrayed a certain way, which is usually as the dumb jock or the jerk, which, you know, most of the time or a lot of the times is certainly the case. But it wasn't totally my experience. In my experience, and sort of I think the more realistic take on it, is that, you know, kids who play sports can be just as cool or dorky or smart or dumb as anybody else. And so I kind of wanted to tap into that and see what it was like to be, you know, to sit on the bench. Whereas Friday Night Lights is a show that's going to show sort of the glory of the sport. You know, what is it like to be a guy on the bench? What might that look like?
Friday Night Lights is, I believe, the only sports-minded drama or dramedy dealing with that level of sports that has made it. Other programs, mostly based on films, such as Breaking Away, which was a wonderful television series with Sean Cassidy back on ABC in the 70s, or The Bad News Bears, it didn't last too long. Maybe a half season, maybe a season, or a season and a half at most. Well, Friday Night Lights ran about 4 or 5 years on NBC, and then later on the DirecTV. It became one of the first television series to be actually saved by something other than an entity other than a broadcast network. How long did it take to come up with the idea of play-by-play, and how did it make your way from your brain to complex networks?
I've been kicking around the idea for a while. I love that you just brought up Breaking Away. That's one of my favorite movies of all time, and I guess I've always kind of gravitated towards that, a movie with a lot of heart and a lot of humor in it. I didn't even know, to bring up what you just said, I didn't know that was a TV show. I had no idea. That's kind of cool. But anyway, to answer your question, I had been kicking out around the idea for a long time, but it kind of crystallized once I got sort of that hook, which it was, you know, a sportscaster looking back on his life. That seemed to really give it sort of a motor. And once that kind of kicked in, I probably wrote the pilot in maybe a month or two. I wrote it on spec, and then you know, gave it to essentially my agent and manager and said, let's find a place who can do this. And bizarrely, it usually doesn't work this way, but pretty quickly, you know, I met with Complex, and they really loved the pilot, and they said that they wanted to make 8 episodes, which was, you know, amazing, and I was really excited. And it was airing on a network called Go 90, which is on right now every Tuesday. But it's Verizon's network, which is called Go 90, a platform that I hadn't heard of. But, I've, you know, learned more about it, and that's what it's on right now. It's pretty cool. It's a free streaming service, and it's got a lot of great stuff on there, and it's accessible to anybody. So that's kind of how it all came together rather quickly, to answer your question.
Incidentally, it is also available, this is Go 90, as I mentioned earlier, it is also available on smart TV sets and smart devices because of a service called Rated Red, which is one of the various channels or services under the Complex Network banner. And that service has been getting involved with smart TV sets and smart devices like Roku and Apple TV and so forth. And they're still expanding the distribution that way. Plus, of course, the work with Go 90. And incidentally, Sean Cassidy, who is the co-star of the TV version of Breaking Away, was on our program early this year because he's Emerald City for NBC. And we talked about Breaking Away, and he still believes that that was one of the best experiences of his life, both as an actor and as a professional, to do that.
Cool.
It was on ABC on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. Steve Teinish, the Oscar-winning writer of Breaking Away, created the show for television, wrote a couple of the scripts, and unfortunately, Barbara Barry and Paul Dooley from the original cast, and unfortunately, it just did not take off, and ABC got scared, and I think they canceled it after 7 episodes. But it was a wonderful show, had a great mood, great framework, beautifully performed. I had hit the spot, and I thought that had ABC kept it going for a full season, it might ultimately have found an audience. But of course,
wow.
Sean later went to the Hardy Boys, and that changed his career, and now he's executive producing all over the place and with his own company and doing really well. Talk about the making of this show. Tell about the main characters and how the narration comes in.
Sure, yeah. We shot the show in Iowa. The show takes place in Illinois outside of Chicago. We ended up shooting in Iowa, which was wonderful. The people there were great, and it's this kind of tight-knit sort of film and TV and artistic community. But I think what was so great about shooting in Iowa is that you have a lot of comedies, especially, where, you know, it's the story says it's set somewhere, but you can tell that it's shot in California. You know, even Freaks and Geeks, which I love, was supposed to be set in Michigan, but it was, you know, shot in Southern California. So we were fortunate enough to go to Iowa, and it just really feels like the show. Tonally, we really wanted to hit that sort of Midwestern spirit or that Midwestern look, and this was really able to do that by us shooting in Iowa, which was great. But the story follows a kid named Pete Hickey, who, you know, does become the sportscaster. And it's really a series about a kid trying to find his voice, which is something that I think, you know, in high school we all do. We're all just kind of trying to figure out who we are. And Pete he plays football and baseball and basketball, and he comes from a really athletic family. Most of the people in his family are far more athletic than him, so he has sort of like this legendary status to live up to, and he is slowly kind of starting to realize that that might not happen. And so it's as he's searching for his voice and his place in the series, he's trying to find his sport. Ultimately, he's going to find his sort of passion for writing and his passion for, you know, sports in general, but on the other side of it, as a sportscaster. So it follows Pete, his best friend Rocco, sort of like a 14-year-old version of Vince Vaughn, who's a bench warmer as well, and their friend Alex, who Pete has a crush on, and just a bunch of other fun characters in this school, this Catholic high school called St. Romans, which is sort of a character itself, as well as the Hickey family, his older brother Mike, who's sort of this idiot who blew out his knee playing college football and now is living at home, his younger sister Gracie, who's, you know, 11 years old but talks like she's 20, who always has the upper hand over her two older brothers, his mom Claire and his dad Steve, who are just, you know, trying to run the place without losing their minds. So that's sort of the setup for the story. It's a lot like Freaks and Geeks in terms of we follow Pete and his friends, but we also follow his family as well. So it's sort of set in two locations, both school and at home.
Pete, by the way, is played by Reed Miller, who's also involved with the Fosters, now about to start his fifth year on Freeform. I believe it's coming next week or two, coming back for that fifth season on Tuesday night, either at 8 o'clock or 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. We are speaking with Kevin Jabkowski. He is the creator executive producer of Play by Play, very unique dramedy, one of the first scripted series for Complex Networks, and specifically for Rated Red. It's available on smart TV sets and smart devices, and also on Verizon's Go 90 mobile service. And Kevin joins us live from Sherman Oaks, California this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Appleman, we'll be live from New York. Delighted you are with us, no matter what area of the U.S. of A. or beyond you are at this hour, this last day of June 2017. Give us a call. Be part of the program. All it takes is using this number, 646-652-2906. The number's good anywhere. You're catching us across the country, around the world, on Blog Talk Radio, or use that chat room. You'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's Simon Apple 04, my name, and already in the room is Guest 698 and Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia. Coming Monday on the program, we'll kick off July with Al Berman. He is executive producer of a new National Geographic special, one of the most ambitious they've ever done, Earth Live. It will be hosted next weekend by Jane Lynch of Glee and Hollywood Game Night fame and Phil Hogan of The Amazing Race. And it will take viewers live to unique corners of the world where nature operates, often in the dead of night. Earth Live next weekend on Nat Geo, also simulcast on Nat Geo Mundo in Spanish and Nat Geo Wild, and Al will be with us live as our lead guest Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, exclusively on Tomorrow We Televise. It sounds like, Kevin, that you're going for the kind of coming-of-age theme that a lot of TV shows all over the place have dealt with, like The Wonder Years, James at 15, Breaking Away is another one like that. I'm curious if you've sort of come up with a formula for how you make a coming-of-age show work.
I'm sorry, how did I come up with a formula for it?
Yeah, did you sort of come up with a formula in doing this series? Have you sort of come up with, like, was there like a guidepost in terms of, you know, how do I make a coming-of-age drama or dramedy work?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think one of the reasons why The Wonder Years works so well, and in conjunction with that, some of my favorite movies like The Sandlot or Stand By Me or A Christmas Story is because they're narrated by an adult looking back on his or her youth, which allows you to do a couple things. One, I think, because when you're in high school, everything is so serious and the stakes are so high, even though looking back, they're not. You know, it's not the end of the world if you don't go to this dance. It's not the end of the world if you miss this field goal. You know, but at the time, they're huge stakes. But when you have a narration that looks back on those stakes, you can do two things. You can have the stakes really matter because the audience cares about this character, but you can also poke fun of it with the narration. So I think that's kind of the formula for a show like this. You're able to touch on some really nostalgic things, especially for people in their 30s now who grew up in the 90s. You can touch on all that stuff, and you can still get a lot of the universal truths of what it's like to grow up, you know, trying to figure out who you are and those sort of formative years. But you can also have a lot of fun with it, and there's a lot of comedy to mine from those 4 years.
Earlier you said that you filmed the program in Iowa. Did you try to go to the Diamond that Field of Dreams was shot at?
I wish. I would have loved to. We didn't have time. And it was also when we ended up finishing the series. It was December, so it was pretty cold, which I'm used to. I'm from Chicago, the Chicago area originally, but I wasn't used to spending 14-hour days shooting outside that length of time. So although I really wanted to go to the Field of Dreams, I was never able to. Hopefully, we did get picked up for seasons 2 and 3 of this show, so hopefully I'll have some time when we start shooting up again in August.
So the show is going to be back for a second, at least a second, and possibly 2 seasons, second and third.
Yes, we got a season 2 and 3 order, and we've been writing for the past couple months, and we're going to start shooting again probably sometime in August.
Congratulations for you, and congratulations to your crew and everybody involved. When I talked to Brockmire's creator a few months ago, he told me that they had a very fast shooting schedule to make this series work. Was that the same with your program?
It was pretty quick, yeah. It was a quick turnaround. I think there's a bit of a learning curve. This is a new network, a new platform. So it was fairly quick. I think we got... You know, I was told that they wanted to make the series probably in July or August. We started writing in September, and we started shooting in November. So it was very quick, and I think it's been a quick turnaround for the second and third seasons as well. But, you know, once you've done one season, you have a lot more of it figured out. So I think we're coming in a little older and a little wiser and better for it for seasons 2 and 3. But it was quick. Sometimes working quick helps. You know, you have to think on your feet more. which I like. But it was a quick shooting schedule.
Did you write all the scripts yourself, or did you put together a small writer's room?
We had a small writer's room, yeah. I wrote the pilot and then, you know, kind of laid out what I wanted for the first season to what I wanted it to look like. And then we hired some really great writers for season one, Justin Bravis, Sean Lavery, and Carrie Doherty. It was a small little room, the four of us. And we wrote 8 scripts together in a few weeks. And then for the second season, we've added a couple more writers. But keeping the room small, I think, is often helpful, especially when you want to when it's a quick turnaround. Sometimes too many ideas is disruptive. So keeping having just some smaller numbers in the writing room, I find, often helps.
We're speaking with Kevin Dombrowski. He is the creator and executive producer of Play by Play. And as you just heard, or if you just joined us, the series, which premiered earlier this week on Rated Red, one of the various channels along the Complex Networks barrier, available on smart TV sets and devices and on Verizon Go 90, has been renewed for a second and third season. That will be happening in 2018 and 2019. Kevin joins us live from Sherman, California this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Glad you're with us for this 90-minute edition wrapping up your June of 2017. Wow, can't believe it. June 30th, first half of the year, almost gone bye-bye. But we are here, and we invite you to part of the program. All it takes is your voice and using this number, 646-652-2906, or use that chat room, SimonApple04 by name, get 698. We have a friend from Philadelphia also in the room. Next Friday on the program, we'll wrap up the first full week of July with John Quinn. He's currently executive producer of Celebrity Name Game, which is wrapping up a third final season syndication on many TV stations along the country, as well as he did Deal or No Deal. And now he is doing Candy Crush. It's CBS' new primetime game show that premieres next Sunday night, hosted by Mario Lopez. John Quinn joins us next Friday, exclusively, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific, on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Where do you want to take your series in year 2 and 3?
Well, a couple places. The season 2 is actually going to take place mostly in the summer. So it ends up with the beginning of season 2 ends with the end, or begins at the end of Pete's freshman year. And so season 2 takes place over his summer vacation, which I think, you know, is an interesting time for a kid. There's, you know, getting your first job, going on family vacation, things like that, which leads us then into season 3. And Pete, his sort of arc for season 1 is trying to become this the varsity kicker for the football team. And season 3 is about, you know, trying to find out if he is going to be able to do that. And along the way, if he's going to be able to eventually date the girl that he really likes, Alex, or are they just going to become friends? And season 3 also touches on Pete really starting to find a passion for sports writing and potentially here if he starts to realize he enjoys sort of the sportscaster thing. There's a press box at football games, and he kind of starts falling in line with some of the guys that are up there. So it's really just, again, about him finding his voice and trying to figure out who he is through sort of this lens of sports.
Despite the tight shooting schedule, the Brockmire people were able to get some notable sportscasters and athletes in their series. Joe Buck, the Foxley broadcaster on football and baseball, was one of those involved. Any possibility that you might try to get a notable sportscaster or notable athlete involved in one of your scripts next year?
Yeah, we would really love to. We've written a couple in for season 2, and hopefully we can get them. And we actually, a really big thrill for me in season 1 was we got Pat Foley to deliver some voiceover. Pat Foley is the play-by-play announcer for the Chicago Blackhawks, and in my mind, the best play-by-play guy in sports. I mean, I grew up listening to him on a little, you know, on a Walkman, you know, when I was supposed to be asleep in bed. It was really a thrill to have him come on board, even just to deliver the few lines that he did. It was really great. We also had Jason Priestley did a quick, fun play-by-play in episode 2 when Pete is trying to ask a girl out for the first time. Jason Priestley of 90210 fame sort of does the play-by-play with older Pete, sort of giving commentary on Pete's sad attempts to ask this girl out, which was a lot of fun. So it's a fun device, and I think there's a lot of room there for having more sort of celebrity voiceovers calling the play-by-play.
Well, if you had your druthers, if there was one person in the sportscasting world that you would love to have, who would that be?
Oh, that's a great question. To be honest, it was Pat Foley, and we got him. but after Pat, I mean, it would be Bob Costas is pretty funny. I think he would do this really, really well. I think I would go with Costas or Dan Patrick. It's such a great voice and such a great personality. I think that would be really fun to have Dan Patrick on the show.
Yeah, and Bob has a Midwestern background because he started as one of the sportscasters for the old ABA, American Basketball Association. He did the St. Louis Spirit Games. But he also
Oh, wow, I didn't know that. Well, then, heck, Bob Costas it is.
Yeah. I'd love to see Kevin Harlan do it. I love Kevin, both on radio. He is the voice of NFL Monday Night Football in Westwood One. He also does the Super Bowl every year. He's one of the great play-by-play callers right now, along with Kevin Kugler, who is the Sunday Night Football commentator on Westwood One all over the country, and, of course, Marv Albert. But I think Kevin would be great because he also has done Midwestern basketball, both college and professional. I think for a number of years he was with the Milwaukee Bucks. So who knows? But he has a great voice. He just has that wonderful rise education. Or Gus Johnson, who for many years was CBS's college basketball play-by-play person on some of the NCAA tournament games, who just knows how to rise to the moment and stuff to stuff.
That's a good call, too.
Take your pick. Absolutely. The program is play-by-play, and you can catch its first season 24/7 on Rated Red. It's one of the many channels of Complex Networks, and you can find it on smart TV sets and smart TV devices or on your mobile phone through Verizon's Go 90 service. For more details about the program online, go to this website, www.complexnetworks.com. That's www.complexnetworks.com. And once again, play-by-play will be back for a second and third season in 2018 and 19. Kevin Jabrakowski, thank you again for joining us. A pleasure to have you. Congratulations on the show and the renewal, and hopefully many more seasons of this program to come.
Simon, thanks so much for having me on the show. I really, really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Kevin. All the greatest. You have a wonderful 4th of July weekend.
You too. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. Kevin Jabrakowski from Play-by-Play on Complex Networks joining us live from Sherman Oaks, California. You are listening to Tomorrow Be Televised. We are the program all about the Tube. We're with you Mondays and Fridays, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. We've had some fantastic guests all June long, and for that matter, all first half of 2017 long. And you can catch all of our episodes on podcast at iTunes.com, I should say. You can catch, of course, on our homepage, 24/7 too. So our homepage is blogtalkradio.com/televised, and on podcast, you got two options. You can go to iTunes.com, or if you have Apple TV, go to the iTunes podcast app. We're one of a number of Blog Talk Radio shows that do both. That's iTunes.com and Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. And if you don't have Apple TV, order it online or go to an Apple store near you. And don't forget, here in the New York area, you can catch me most Mondays on BK Live. We do a Tomorrow We Televised segment between noon and 1 o'clock on that program, which talks about all things Brooklyn and beyond. So join Brian and Greg and Aaron and Melody and the gang in the New York area on Brick TV for BK Live, the Emmy Award-winning television program about all things Brooklyn and beyond. It's from noon to 1 o'clock. If you are watching anywhere in New York City, you can catch the program and the network on Verizon Fios TV in Manhattan and Brooklyn, Charter Spectrum in Brooklyn on Cablevision Systems, Altice USA, and RCN. And all my Blog Talk Radio, all of my BK Live segments are available on YouTube at youtube.com/BrickTV. That's youtube.com/BrickTV. So check them out. And also you can check out my Tomorrow We Televised columns on the web at MediaVillage.com. That's MediaVillage.com. My latest column deals with the new newscast on Univision, Edition Digital, which is not only available from noon 12:30 nationally, but many Univision stations around the country doing their own local version, including New York, California through KMAX in Los Angeles, Houston, and as of this week, Chicago and San Antonio. The San Antonio version at 12:30 local time, or 11:30 local time, is simulcast in English and Spanish. It's bilingual, and both on Univision radio stations in San Antonio and also on an English language radio station, too. That's Edition Digital. Find out all about it, both national and local, at MediaVillage.com. When we come back, it's all Monty Python's Flying Circus from here we've got the trio of writers who made Monty Python FAQ happen. Chris Bertanti, Brian Koch, and Jeff Massey joins us from the Big Apple and Rockville Center, Long Island, as we pause near the top of the hour for web identification. It's www.blogtalkradio.com, the best internet radio on the planet, with more than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your offer, Sports Time Radio. Check out that crew every Sunday, 8 a.m. Eastern, 5 a.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. And again, best feature available 24/7 at YouTube.com. So check it out anytime you like. Welcome back to the Robbie Televised, final episode of June 2017, first half of this year. And we welcome those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. 90th edition coming your way to wrap up the month. Glad you are aboard. 86 degrees at the top of the hour. It's a very humid time here in the Big Apple. But all is good. It is bright and sunny. We hope wherever you are, it is a bright, sunny day where you are. We invite you to be part of the program. We have a trio of great guests coming your way in the half hour ahead. And as always, be in the action. All you got to do is raise your voice and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Number is good anywhere you catch us across the country, around the globe here on BTR. And we've got our chat room going, Simon Apple 04 my name, with guests 698, Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, in the room. So be on the phone, be in the room. Either way, we will hear you. And don't forget, you can connect to others by using Facebook timeline. Click on the Blog Talk Radio screen with the Facebook icon on it and follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. The 1960s and the 1970s were very big transformational times for comedy on both sides of the Atlantic. For example, there were shows like That Was the Week That Was. It started in England, then for a while it was in the United States. And then later in the 60s, there was Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. And then in the 70s, it was Monty Python's Flying Circus. And it was one of the most groundbreaking TV comedies ever, with an incredible array of talent, a group of people whose talent was incredible. Well, now there is a new book about the era of Monty Python and how flying circus went. And we are about to speak with the authors of that book, published by Applause Books, the latest in the FAQ series, Monty Python FAQ. Joining us live from here in New York and Rockville Center, Long Island, are the trio behind this book, Chris Bertanti, Brian Koch, and Jeff Massey. Gentlemen, welcome in.
How are you, Simon?
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having us, Simon.
A pleasure. Thanks for spending some of your free holiday weekend with us. We appreciate it. By the way, later on in the half hour, we will announce our classic trivia question answer, and we'll give you the honor of getting that through. I'm sorry we didn't have a winner, but and we are offering the Monty Python FAQ book, your book, as a prize. So we'll tell you about that when we get to it a little later on in the half hour. Chris, why did you decide to for you and your colleagues to discuss Monty Python?
I mean, it's hard to imagine the part or the an aspect of comedy in the 20th century that Monty Python didn't really revolutionize. I mean, it's not saying too much to say that they were the most subversive comedy troupe of the century. And I think so much of what we see today in television and online comedy is inspired by them. Whether people know it or not, people are seeing Monty Python style humor if they've never even watched a single episode of The Flying Circus.
Brian, how long did it take for the Monty Python gang, Michael Palin, John Cleese, Graham Chapman, et cetera, to take their concept and get it on the BBC in the early 70s?
Well, it's the BBC back in those days was a lot different than the BBC now, and there weren't really all that many programs on a lot of times, and so they had a slot that was open, and depending on who you believe, either John Cleese got them all together or producer got them all together, and essentially they had no plans as to what they're going to do. They said, do you have a plot or an outline? No. Do you have ideas what you're going to do? No. What's it called? We're not sure yet. And with that in mind, they still put them on the air.
God bless the BBC.
Which is kind of amazing today that wouldn't be allowed. But because they were never really revealed what they were going to do, they were free to do anything they wanted to do, which is why it's so important.
Jeff, were the members of Monty Python inspired by shows like Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In or That Was the Week That Was, that paved the way for the kind of rapid-fire sketch comedy, the quick cuts and so on and so forth that Python became famous for?
Well, Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In pretty much came in simultaneously, so I don't think there was a direct correlation there. But many of the members of Monty Python were, in fact, part of That Was the Week That Was, and they all came up through the Oxbridge-Cambridge Circus type of system. So many of them had worked with each other in smaller groups. You got Gilliam kind of being the oddball American. But all the Brits had worked with each other in piece and parts along the way, and so they had kind of formed little cliques of weirdness before they became Monty Python. Influenced by the Goons for the most part, however.
Yeah, tell me about that. The Goonies, of course, was the famous radio show. The Goon Show was the famous radio show that Peter Sellers started his fame on. And it was the same kind
of
situation where you never knew what episode, and you never knew what they would do every episode, because every episode was different, and sometimes they do more than one sketch in the show.
Absolutely. And that idea of disjointed sketch comedy was something that the Pythons kind of deconstructed to the nth degree on television.
Chris, when the Python clan got together to put this together, how formulated was their concept of this show? How fighting the comedy was going to be? Was it going to have animation off the bat, which turned out to be one of the major elements of the show from start to finish every episode? But also the ability to, were they out to call it like anything for a laugh, even if it tweak some stiff upper lip people?
Well, for one, I don't think they care too much about offending anybody. And whereas they would do anything for a laugh, but not necessarily for the audience's laugh. All they really cared about was making themselves laugh. So in terms of the idea that they had to put a show together, most of these guys had been working together in, little groups on different shows that have been on the BBC, and they just knew that they wanted to do their own show. And they had a lot of material that had been rejected as going too far. Oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. And as Brian was mentioning, they finally got the opportunity that the BBC, that the BBC gave them to do their own show, and basically the grown-ups left the room and allowed them to do whatever they wanted. So their basically driving principle was, we want to do a show together, and also we hate punchlines. And that's where Terry Gilliam's animation came in. That was a really handy way of stitching together all these sketches, which really didn't have endings. They would just get to the end of the funny part, cut, cartoon, move on.
How big Chris was timing in all this? Knowing when to go from one sketch to another, how to do it either seamlessly or do a quick cut.
They were masters of timing, but I will say that there are times when the show can seem incredibly random, and obviously that's a sign of very intense thought on their part. But often they would just shoot a lot of material, and it almost took longer to kind of stitch it together than it did to actually shoot it.
We're speaking with the trio of writers behind Monty Python FAQ, the new book about Monty Python's Flying Circus, one of the greatest comedy, and I say one of the classics of any genre of television of all time. Started in the BBC, then came into this country largely through public television, and you can still see the reruns all over the place anywhere. And our guests are Chris Versace, Brian Cogan, Jeff Ness. The book was published by Applause Books and Cinema, and they are with us live from New York, both New York City and Rockwell Center, Long Island, on Tomorrow We Televise. Tom and Apple Bannerman with you live from New York. And coming up later this half hour, we'll reveal the answer to this week's Python question of our Clapper Trivia Question of the Week. Unfortunately, nobody got it right, but we'll let our folks give you the answer. And we will offer their book next week as our prize, so stay tuned, because we'll tell you how you can win next week and get a copy of this book for yourself. And if you have a question or comment for our guest, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Next Friday on Tomorrow We Televise, one of the executive producers of CBS's new primetime game show, Candy Crush, from Lionsgate, John Quinn, will join us. He was the executive producer with Scott St. John of Celebrity Name Game, the first who won the Emmy Award 2 of the last 3 years hosting that show. Also was involved with Scott on Deal or No Deal. And John will be with us live next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Candy Crush premieres, I believe it's next Sunday night, with Mario Lopez hosting on CBS. Chris, when did the Python clan know that their satire was working? And when did the BBC know, we have a hit here, or have we got problems?
Well, I think the BBC started to know, the Python group knew that the BBC was starting to be more interested in their success when they actually started paying attention to what they were doing, for one. And I think, I don't know, the other guys will have to back me up on this, but I think they started to know towards the end of the first season. And I remember Eric Idle talked about he would get together with a bunch of guys and play soccer in Hyde Park every week. And at first the guys, they'd watch the show and then they'd see him playing soccer and they'd say, that was a weird show you did last night. And then later on in the season, they started saying, that was a funny, weird show you did last night. So I think at that point they started to know they were making some progress.
Yeah, I think when they first started doing some small tours of England and they realized that people outside of their London clique kind of recognized them, when they found that there were college kids in England that were really devoted, they knew they had something.
Well, when they had their first live show at that, was it Coventry College, and they got there and they saw that people were actually dressing up as their characters in the audience, that really surprised them.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, is there a universal agreement that the show really got its rhythm in the second season?
I'm not going to go against that. There's certainly some awesome bits in the first season, but the second season is pretty much a gem. Many people will argue that the fourth season sort of whimpers off, but I think there's a lot of strength in all of the middle seasons. Two's a big one, though.
Yeah, two and three are when they're really sort of realizing they can do anything they want to do, and they're also in a room working with each other and going back and forth, and they need to make the others in the room laugh in order to get it on the air. And so they really sort of stepped up their game for season two to try and say, like, okay, wait, Klee says that? I'm going to top Klee with this.
Yeah, at that point, as they say in a number of their biographies, at that point they're having a hard time remembering who wrote what, where earlier you could tell from the rhythm or from the style of each sketch who wrote what bit. But by the end of season two, certainly, or mid-season two, they're starting to try to one-up each other on their own terms, and that's a great synergy to have.
And season three was the last one that where they had the full bunch, because wasn't it season four when John Cleese left?
Absolutely. And then they start recycling stuff a bit more from their college days, which is a bit telling.
Well, if you deconstructed all of comedy, where do you go from there?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you can almost see, I don't want to use the word desperation, but you start to see that in the later episodes.
Yeah.
Well, it seems that one thing that the Python bunch didn't believe in was continuing characters. Unlike Saturday Night Live, where in the course of a season you will see this player play this same character, real or fictional, over and over again. Or like an Alec Baldwin playing Donald Trump, or Daryl Hammond playing, you know, Jimmy Carter. That the Pythons did not believe in doing that kind of comedy, where they would be known for specific characters. Is that a fair assessment?
It is.
In a way.
But they did have reoccurring characters such as the knight with
the chicken.
They had
the Gumbies, the colonel, right?
Graham Chapman's colonel cutting off skits because they were too silly.
Absolutely. And all the Pepper Potts. I mean, those are essentially the same characters. They just don't have to have the same names, but they're the same type of character that recurs in various sketches.
But they're not trying to be topical either. They're not trying to say, like, who's going to imitate, the prime minister, who's going to imitate a government figure. If they wanted it to be timeless, they didn't want many skits grounded specifically in this time period.
And when they did include topical figures, those sketches kind of fell flat. I think they knew that.
Yeah. Did you have a chance of putting this book together to talk to as many of the existing Python members that are still alive?
I sat one row behind the Pythons at a screening for Holy Grail, but that is as close to talking to them as I ever got.
Yep.
I briefly talked to Neil Innes, Rob's minstrel, but we didn't get a chance to talk to the original Pythons. And Graham Chapman was particularly hard to get in touch with.
Absolutely. Right. He's a stickler for that boy.
Never returned our calls.
Yes.
Very rude.
He's a little quiet these days.
Two other things that people remember fondly from Monty Python. One is the men cross-dressing and also using their raised voice. And also, of course, and now for something completely different, especially when that desk news-like with John Cleese was by a seaside. How did they come up with those bits?
Well, that's actually a stolen catchphrase that had been popping around on the BBC earlier on a children's show. And then on, I believe it was at last the 1948 show.
Yes.
And that was a partial Python project. The last 1948 show was a couple of Pythons as well as...
Do not adjust your set. It was essentially three were in one, and more or less three, maybe four were in the other one.
Right.
And that's how they got to... They loved each other's shows, by the way.
Right.
And then they eventually decided to merge as a group.
But something like Atlanta, now for something completely different, does become entirely associated with the Pythons by the time they're making their sort of clip show films.
Right.
Nobody really remembers the other shows anymore.
No.
We have a call. We're going to take it. Hello, you're on Tamari Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, Simon. It's Rick Webb calling from Philadelphia.
Hey, Rick. Good to hear you. I had a hunch you were going to be part of this conversation. Go right ahead with the authors of Monty Python FAQ.
Well, first, Simon, I had a question for you. Am I allowed to win the book, or is that that question over?
Question's over, unfortunately. I'll tell you what. I wanted to let the authors give the answer. So, unfortunately, nobody wins this week. Let me ask the question. Rick will come up with the answer and then see if the gentlemen agree, okay?
So the question we had
this week was, name the theme song of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Name the theme song of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And Rick, you say?
I say it's the Liberty Bell March, and it's John Philip Sousa.
He's right.
That is correct.
Absolutely.
That is correct.
Give the man a book.
Yep. I know that.
Jeff, how did the Python folks come up with that theme?
I think that the usual answer that they give is that it was public domain and therefore cheap.
Right.
But they did really like the idea of there being a sort of final bell involved. I think it was Palin and
maybe Idle.
And possibly Idle. But they were talking about just looking for something that really had nothing to do with anything they were going to be doing on the show.
And weren't they literally just pawing through all the records in the BBC archives, playing one record after another?
Yep. And it really has a nice final ring to it.
Which goes well with the foot coming down.
Absolutely.
Right.
Plus, if you see the opening title, it does have the bell at the beginning, and it also has, when the guy says, my name is Python's Flying Circus, you
absolutely
see the bell.
Absolutely. Gilliam,
the,
of course,
title.
Prep those, but yes, absolutely. Works in well.
Right.
Kind of hard to divide the two nowadays. You can't really hear that song without hearing them. I was on a merry-go-round the other day and I heard it, and it's very hard not to think Monty Python when you hear that song.
Yeah. And with that title, gentlemen, there's something else I think of. I call it the poosh. Right. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da with a foot.
Yep.
Who came up with the foot coming down at the end?
Yeah, they were fond of sort of graphic, explosive sound effects. Very fond of fart noises, for one thing.
And a lot of that was Gilliam in particular. Gilliam loved nothing more than taking some really beautiful painting or a piece of music like that and just squashing it and ripping it and doing something incredibly violent to it.
That's what Gilliam said himself. He loved to take the classics and then just destroy them.
Right.
All right, Rick, go ahead with your question.
Okay. Well. First, since somebody just mentioned merry-go-round, I just wanted to mention that John Philip Sousa used to play that song all the time at the mall. Well, now it's a mall near where I live, but it used to be an amusement park with all kinds of rides and stuff like that. And during the whole summer, John Philip Sousa would play there just outside of Philadelphia. But my question is actually about Crunchy Frog. Like, do you guys know where on earth that came from?
I'll be honest, I got nothing.
I don't know the origin. I mean, the origins of a lot of the sketches are based upon usually one of the pythons would have an experience, say, like, look at chocolate and wonder. I've never read any story specifically that said how they came up with that, but I think it's like, what are the different kinds of chocolate? Is it a pralines? Is it this and that? And then someone must have just said, well, how about a frog inside it?
Right.
Specifically, we're not sure, but you can see the reasoning process that went into making that skit.
It was also, I think, they loved any skit that allowed them to come up with a long list of really exaggerated, ridiculous names.
Also true.
And if they were gross-sounding, all the better.
Yeah, that's kind of a half-thesaurus sketch where they just like to name things over and over. Like the cheese shop sketch is a great example.
One of Cleese's specialties.
Yes.
Right.
Rick, do you have any insight into the Crunchy Frog?
No. I just always thought it was amazing. Like at the end, the Native American who fights into wanting, and he recognizes it immediately. He's like, "Crunchy Frog."
Right.
Yeah.
I just thought that was like
slightly inappropriate or a title.
Right.
It was just like an extra stroke of genius, and it's always like the unexpected thing is the funny thing. So it was unexpected, but then it was doubly unexpected that the Native American, American Indian, immediately recognizes, oh, this is Crunchy Frog.
Right.
Of course.
Right.
Also, the prime rule is no punchlines, just do something weird to get to the next guest.
That's true.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I'm looking to learn more from your book that I just won, Simon.
Nicely done, by the way. Sir.
Well, Rick,
right,
you
very
got
well.
To answer some questions first. What is your quest?
What is my quest?
What is your quest?
I wasn't ready for all this.
No one expects a quiz or the
no.
Exactly. Dun. You know. I just called in to win a book. But thank you guys. Thank you for sticking up for me because I know Simon didn't want to let go of this book.
Anything we can do to give away our very laboriously written book, you know, the better.
Absolutely.
I'm loving it. Thank you guys.
All right.
Take care.
And,
take care.
Continued success. Thank you.
Right.
Simon, have a great weekend.
You too. Have a great day, Rick. Take care. Rick Webber, our friend from Philadelphia. And I'll tell you what, we're going to work with Applause Books to see that he gets a copy of Monty Python FAQ. And we're going to offer it because we didn't get any winner this week until Rick joined in. We are going to offer it next week as our Classic Trivia Question prize. So we'll post a new Classic Trivia Question for you on Monday's show. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please include your name and your full mail address. And if you miss the question on Monday, we'll post it Independence Day on Facebook and on my own Twitter hashtag at UBCSimonTWBT. That's a UBCSimonTWBT. Remember, in order to win, you got to play in and play in by email, okay? So we'll have that question for you on Monday. And again, we'll have Chris, Brian, and Jeff's book available for you. And they're still available for a few more minutes. So if you want to give them a call, like Rick just did, please do. 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. What did the Python members feel about having females in their troupe? Carol Cleveland was like the only female Python, really. And I'm curious what they thought about that. And did they try to, as time went on, to try to bring more women into the act?
I think that they understood that they weren't good at writing for women, and it's not, I think, that they didn't want women on stage. Many of them had worked with women in other sketched comedies before. They just were so hungry to be on stage all the time that they wanted every part. And so regardless of gender or how many people had to wear a gray wig and a frumpy housecoat, they just wanted to be there. And so... yes, they recognized that they were not great at writing for women. Carol Cleveland seems to have been their favorite by the time all things were concerned. She was their glamour stooge. We make a bit of an argument in our book that she's the seventh Python, in fact.
Right.
Yeah, although Connie Booth does appear in quite a few episodes.
Yeah. Connie Booth is a big one.
As long as Mrs. Idol, Eric Idol's wife, who somehow did not have her own name.
Yeah.
I think it's also possible, and I'm not trying to accuse them of sexism here, but given the milieu they came out of, the idea of writing in a lot of female characters just may not even have really occurred to them at
no.
the time. It
not
just
as much
wasn't
as
something that.
Now.
Yeah, it just wasn't something that happened. Also, they realized they just really enjoyed putting on dresses and playing all the female roles themselves. Why not?
Yeah. It came from a panto tradition
yeah,
where men
right.
would dress as women constantly, and so that was yeah. part of the funny.
But they knew that these were sort of grotesque as well, hence they called them the pepper pots. They weren't trying
yeah.
to be
right.
usually a straight woman character.
Right, or attractive for that matter.
Right, and it made
yeah.
for an easy laugh. You don't even, you know, the outfits and the voices get a laugh alone, regardless of what they're doing or saying.
Chris, when the Pythons did their four seasons of Flying Circus, they were doing it at a time where it was really a golden age of British comedy all over the tube,
right.
with people like Eric McCambridge and Ernie Wise. There was Dave Allen, the wonderful Mile Otis. There was other shows as well. Oh, Doctor in the House. There were Yes Minister.
Which many of the Pythons wrote for,
Black
by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was Benny Hill, who, of course, did his own little cross-dressing. Very funny comedian, used women a lot, too. Very great on musical numbers and sketch artists. Had his own little troupe of Python-esque, if you will, players. Did the Python people have any people that they aspire to, or did they have any favorites in that whole clan of British humorists at the time?
Well, they had certain people that they had worked with in the past before, like Marty Feldman, you know, and who they really, did work with in the past and aspired to work with again. But at that point, I think it wasn't so much who they were aspiring to work with as just being able to get their material on the air, honestly.
Well,
and at that point,
people like Peter Cook and Spike Milligan were also huge heroes
right.
for them. And when they'd see them, they'd sort of shake themselves like, I'm not worthy.
Yeah.
Well, they were almost worried that Spike Milligan was going to scoop them with before they got to their first
Absolutely.
Season.
With the show Q,
yeah.
and then Q
right.
5 and
yeah.
7.
Right.
Yeah. Incidentally, gentlemen, Marty Feldman did a variety show on ABC. It was a summer show, and he introduced segments from Monty Python's Flying Circus, if I remember correctly, on that show. So
yep.
many people, that program was their first introduction to Monty Python while the series was still on the air. We only have a few seconds left. Gentlemen, do you have another FAQ book in mind for the down the road?
Well, I mean, obviously Benny Hill.
It'll just be 400 pages of thwap, thwap, thwap noises.
We're working
right.
on the next project, Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory.
Ah, nice.
That's it.
Somebody should do Benny Hill. I'm a big fan. I see Benny Hill clips on YouTube. I just laugh hysterically.
Yeah.
I know my dad did. He was watching the show on Channel 9. It was on 11 o'clock for many
yeah.
years here in New York. And that show, even at half, it's an hour, but it was half hour length, the syndication. And you still laugh out loud at that man's jokes,
mm-hmm.
and no matter how crude they might have been.
You should play
Absolutely.
Us out to Yakety Sax.
There you go.
I think so.
Yes,
a nice book on the goodies would be a reasonable one as well. They are sort of the Monty Python of a parallel universe BBC Five or something.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, gentlemen, it's a wonderful book, Chris, Brian, and Jeff. It's Monty Python FAQ, and if you want to know everything about Monty Python Flying Circus and the people that made it happen, what they did after Monty Python, for example, John Cleese and his wife at the time, Connie Booth, with Faulty Towers, Michael Palin, and some of the shows he did afterward. Check this book out. It's wonderful. It's published by Close Books and Cinema, available all over the place. And again, we'll be offering a copy of it again next week with our classic trivia question contest. Monty Python FAQ, and check out the other FAQ books as well. If you want to know more details, go to Close Books and Cinema's website, applausebooks.com. Chris Bresanti, Brian Kogan, Jeff Massey, thank you all for joining us and making our wrap-up of June and the first half of this year such a fun one. It's been a pleasure to have all three of you on.
Thank you much, Simon.
Thanks, Simon.
You're welcome. Have a great fourth. Take care.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The trio behind Monty Python FAQ from Flow's Books, Chris Bresanti, Brian Kogan, Jeff Massey, joining us live from New York City and Rockville Center, Long Island. Thanks to all of our guests today and all of our guests all June long in the first half of 2017. Remember, if you want to check up on all of our episodes this year so far, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out the podcast at iTunes.com. And also go to Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. And remember, we love hearing from you. What do you think about our program? What do you think about where TV is at and where it's going into the second half of 2017? I'd love to know. So email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's your ticket to our classic question of the week. Also, you can find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter, UBC Simon TWBT. That's at UBC Simon TWBT. We always love hearing from you. Why? Because what you say matters. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants, not three of those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Eddie Toe is Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Steinberg, executive content producer. The co-founders of this very enterprise are Al Levy and Bob Cherish. The Monty Televised is brought to you today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. For Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a fantastic 4th of July holiday weekend. Please make it a safe and great one. Be great with your loved ones, whatever you're doing. And we'll catch you back here Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.